Messy Realities, the Secret Life of Technology. Well, hello, my name is Gemma Hughes. I'm a health services researcher at Oxford University, and I, with my colleagues and friends, have put together this podcast series called Messy Realities, the Secret Life of Technology. The series describes how we took our research into assisted living technologies to the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford in search of some new meaning and inspiration. In this episode, we bring together an interesting collection of people to explore an interesting collection of objects. We've created a grouping of researchers, museum facilitators, and community members to explore some objects from the museum collection alongside objects found in our research. So, Beth, I'm going to ask you to introduce us to this lovely collection of people and tell us how you know them.
Well, I'm really thrilled to introduce our newest members to the podcast this afternoon. We have Jean, and I'm going to say Jean and Sheila, because actually you come together often, which is just so lovely. Always, yes. And I've known you both for, well, quite some time now. I've known Sheila since Meet Me at the Museum, where she used to bring someone that she cared for with her. And then Jean sort of followed suit as Sheila said, you know, Jean, you might be interested in this Messy Realities lark. Caitlin, you may have met on other podcasts, but Caitlin is a great researcher and has been contributing to thinking about the Messy Realities. Josie is my colleague and good friend at the museum, who I bounce ideas off, she bounces ideas with me. We talk rubbish sometimes, but sometimes get to some great gems. So that's Josie. And Gemma, I'm sure you know lots about Gemma by now, is a fantastic researcher who said, why not in the Pitt Rivers, can we talk about medical objects? And then George is somebody that I met through Messy Realities and really captivated and excited the group for his own knowledge and worth, as well as for Harrow the seal, who we will be introduced to later. But I know that we'll have a really great chat together this afternoon.
Thanks, Beth. Can you tell us a little bit about the amulets that we looked at? Beth, do you remember which ones we brought into our discussions?
So there was a really interesting one, and we have a really great photograph of it, which hopefully people will see on the podcast website. We have a beautiful woven pendant here, which has a small Martinia seed in it. And a Martinia seed looks a little bit like the teeth of a snake. And that's really useful, because if you're going to use it as an amulet for protection against snake bites, what you do is you find something that looks like the object you're trying to scare away or protect yourself from. And you then house it in something incredibly beautiful. So there's this woven grass that's been very finely made into a circle that holds your Martinia seed in place that you can then wear around your neck. Lots of people imbue objects that look like things with special amuletic properties, and this is known as sympathetic magic. So we've got the Martinia seed that looks like a snake's fangs, and that protects you from snake bites. But you might find a piece of squid called a belemnite that people used to think was a part of a lightning rod that had melted the earth. And in this country, people would put these into their walls, because lightning doesn't strike twice. You put it in your wall, and that protects your house from burning down. Now, you only find out your amulet doesn't work when your house is burnt down around your ears. But it's all about the fact that sympathetic magic is part of our everyday. So we may think that some of these things are outlandish, or why didn't they know it was a fossil from, you know, 50 million years ago? How silly. But actually, we all do things like that today. I have a necklace that I wear that I was bought by my sister on her wedding day. And I wear that to all my interviews. Every time I've worn that, I've got the job. So now I don't not wear the necklace, because I won't get the job. Mm. So all of us have those things. And I know, Sheila, that you have some jewellery and things that you've had designed for you that have been created with a belief involved in it, that you might want to share.
Yeah, I got a medic alert bracelet, which is not actually got on there what my allergies and that are, but it's got my membership number and a phone number. So that if I sort of get found unconscious or something, there's the paramedics can phone up and find out exactly what my allergies are.
So it's a good thing for an emergency
situation. Yes.
What about jewellery though? Jason, you've told us about your necklace. Are you wearing it today?
I'm not wearing it. So my second name is Kettle. And I have, I don't know if you remember, do you remember I have a little kettle, it's almost a medallion that I wear. So my dad has a very big one, which is probably about that big, and he had one made my mum, which was slightly smaller, and then all of us kids have one that goes down in size, and I'm the youngest, so I've got the tiny kettle.
So all the kettles have got a little kettle hanging around their neck.
Yeah, I'm the lowest kettle, although I am now the tallest. So a bit like Beth, I wear that too. Although I am being interviewed today, in some sense, I wear it to all my interviews, and it actually needs a clean at the moment, that's why I'm not wearing it.
So you've got jewellery as well.
Yeah,
some tissue.
I've got a heart which I had engraved. It's got on there Cassie Hughes left paw prints in my heart, and it's got dog paw prints on there, and that was for my little collie cross that I lost. I had to put to sleep at the age of 16, 3.5 years ago, and she was almost like a soulmate. I know that sounds odd, but she always knew when I wasn't feeling well, and equally I knew when she wasn't well. We were just so in tune with each other that when I lost her, I felt I had to have something that I could wear that would always be with me as part of her, sort of thing.
So you've got a physical thing with you that's got a lot of emotional value for you.
Yes.
It brings you some reassurance, would you say, or some comfort, or...?
I just feel I've always got her with me.
Right.
I don't know whether it's reassurance or comfort, but I just feel that I've got part of her there, even though it's not part of her.
Yeah. It's to you.
Like your kettle in a way.
Yeah. You know, I feel like my, kind of my family's with me when I'm wearing it.
Yes,
Do you have anything similar, Jean, that you wear?
Yes, I wear, everybody asks me if it's a watch. It's not, it's a magnet.
Oh.
Both sides. Years and years ago, must be well over 40, somebody said magnets helped or something. Anyway, this was a present and bought it, and I'm lost if I haven't got it on.
So is that because you're so used to wearing it that you feel that if without it you don't feel right? Is that?
Yes, that's right.
So,
but at the same, I don't know actually whether it's just because it's not there or if I do feel there's something that's working.
So what...
Because I always had creaks in my hands. And my thumbs weren't too good. They're not now, but my hands are improving.
So the magnet in the... So you're wearing this around your wrist.
Yes,
it looks a bit, as you say, like a watch. But it's got some
it's
properties.
Got a magnet.
Ah, right. So you can
so
see
it goes right through me.
So that's got some properties that you think help you with your... Have you got arthritis in your hands or...?
I've got rheumatoid arthritis at bay.
Right.
I'm not on medication for it.
Ah, okay.
A few years ago, my hands were like that and couldn't do anything. Now I can straighten it up. I can even cross my fingers, which I couldn't do. Not that much.
But so I'm just going to describe...
I don't know whether I believe that does it.
Mm.
Or whether it's just hope and think, well, if it's there, I can't do any harm.
Yes, yes. So, and you've got used to wearing it as well.
Yes.
And it's also something that's attractive. It looks nice as well. It's something that you enjoy wearing, I guess. Yeah. When we looked at amulets, we brought together some beautiful objects, like your jewellery, with some of the more functional technologies that we'd found in our research. So we paired amulets with pendant alarms or panic buttons. And we've got an example of a pendant alarm in the photograph, and we've got one here. They're very functional objects. They don't look particularly attractive. but they're very useful for people. You've got one of these at home, Sheila, is that right? You use one of these? Yeah. And we had some designers in our workshops with us who gave some thought to how these kinds of objects might be designed in a way that would be a bit more appealing, a bit more attractive. And you spent some time talking to Phil, who is one of our designers. Can you tell us a bit about the conversation you had with him?
The conversation Phil and I had was, I've also worked with older people that have got these pendant alarms, and they've either got the pendant or the wristband. And the general consensus from people was they didn't want to wear them because it either singled them out or they looked ugly. And so Phil and I worked on trying to make these alarm systems personalised through either a pendant or a bracelet, or even like a pin from if it was a male person that needed it. And we did an awful lot of work on various types of jewellery that could be adapted into it. And I think sort of between Phil and I, with me sending him photographs of bits of my jewellery and him adding his designs, I think we came up with some quite good ideas in various forms. Actually, a follow-on from that, because I've got a Medic Alert bracelet, somebody from Medic Alert phoned me and I told them that I'd been on this Messy Realities thing. And they actually, I don't know whether Phil ever phoned them, but they actually asked for Phil to phone them to see if the three of us could work together on them extending their service. Because part of what Phil and I were working on as well was not just the look of it, but that they could pick up if somebody had had a fall or if they'd stopped breathing. And taking it a step further than that, that if their heart rate went, it would flag up in a call centre that they needed medical assistance or something, you know, for a nurse or a doctor to be called and go to see them. So we were sort of looking into the future quite a long way to see how the pendant alarms could be taken into the future to give people a lot more freedom of living in their own home. And even to the extent that if it was somebody with dementia and they wanted to go out, they could be tracked through the same piece of jewellery to find out where they were, which would give an awful lot of older people and younger people with dementia a lot of more freedom to what people have got today.
That's a brilliant link to some of the things that we're going to talk about a bit later on. So thanks for that. And it also links nicely to some of the other discussions we've had in some of the other podcasts around some of the tracking devices that are being tested at the moment for people with dementia. But some of the problems have been creating objects that people are happy to wear. So I think when you were talking to Phil about something that might be good for you, it looked a bit like a chart. He drew something for you, didn't he? And it looked a bit like a charm bracelet.
One of the photographs I sent him, I think, was of a charm bracelet. And Phil designed it sort of so you could have different charms on there, which would perhaps send out different signals for different things. There was other jewellery that I sent as well, sort of like necklaces and things like that. We were sort of trying to think of a size that would take a chip that would register things in it as well.
Yeah, I mean, there are some devices on the market that are a bit more beautiful and a bit more like jewellery, but they're still not really widely used. The things that people tend to have in their homes tend to be the more medical-looking devices that are quite functional but aren't necessarily as appealing, and then people don't necessarily wear them, so you get this kind of vicious cycle of people not wearing them because they don't like the look of them, so then they don't really work because they're not really wearing them. So it can be quite problematic how something looks and feels.
They've taken them off.
They've taken them off.
I've had two friends of mine who didn't have their cord wrapped around their neck. Both had had falls. One, we don't know how long she'd fallen the night before or whether she'd fallen that morning. She was half dressed. My other friend had fallen. Somehow she managed to get hold of me on the phone, but her alarm was the other side of the room, you know. So they really need something that's on their wrist so that they're there all the time.
Yeah. There's also a sense that, you know, the panic button or the pendant alarm does one thing, and sometimes people have quite a lot of different
technologies to do lots of different things. And as you said, maybe putting them together into one thing that you can put on your wrist that does a bit more. Yeah, be a lot easier.
The other thing is, if you've got dementia and you've got half a dozen round your wrist, you could end up by doing the lock.
Well, this was why we were trying to design something that would just take one, perhaps chip, that would do a lot of things that people would want to wear. I mean, I've had people that I've worked with said that all this equipment in their house makes them feel they're in a hospital.
Exactly. Yeah.
It can really change the nature of your home.
And the way you live in it and the way you interact and the way you feel in it. Because I think one of my participants, she said she participated in a study where that she had to weigh herself every day. This is for heart failure. So weight is indicative of when you end up having a lot of water on your body because your heart isn't pumping so well. So if your weight goes up, then you probably don't feel very well. And this scale was attached to a hospital at the other end, so her data was sent every morning that she weighed herself. But she said she actually stopped the study because it just reminded her that she was ill. Mm-hmm. And she said, that's not the way I want to feel. And she basically took a lot of the things out of her house that made her feel ill in some way, within reason, obviously. She was quite well with heart failure. But yeah, I think these things do fundamentally change the way you feel.
I think something I've also seen is people might have a pendant alarm, but they don't want to push it because they're worrying about bothering somebody. Even though they might be really quite poorly, they don't want to cause any burden to anyone else. So the technology doesn't work on its own. It has to be used in the right way, doesn't it?
Well, I had one for my husband, and I had to press it a lot if he'd fallen or something. I could not get him up.
Yeah.
So I just had to use it.
Yeah.
The other thing with the pendant alarms as well is they don't work outside the house.
Yes.
No, so it's only working if they're in their own home. Once they go out in the garden or out to get a newspaper, there's no contact with the call centre.
Yeah, so we had one of our colleagues, Jenny, told us about one of her research participants, Caitlin. Do you remember she had a participant who would wear a pendant alarm out and about, and that was really interesting.
It seemed like that sense of protection kind of followed them, even though they apparently also, you know, were quite vocal about the fact that they didn't expect it to work outside, but it was, they brought it with them anyway.
It was comfort.
Yeah, comfort.
I think it was comfort and reassurance, but I think also I think they wore it as a bit of a signal. It was a bit of the other side of what you were saying earlier, is that people don't like to be singled out as being vulnerable or needing help. Actually, I think this person wanted people to know that he was vulnerable, and that's one of the reasons why he wore his alarm. So if he was out, people would offer him help if he needed it. So the same meaning, it can be used in different ways for people. Yeah. George, I was going to ask you to come into the conversation now. We've been talking about how technology might help people, and Sheila's been talking about new advances in technology. Can you just tell us a little bit about your work in general that you've been doing, and perhaps introduce us to some of the technologies that you know about?
Yeah, sure. So I direct a research institute here at Oxford called the Institute of Population Ageing, and we do research on the drivers and implications of population structural change around the world, in different regions, different countries in those regions. And that's looking at the implications of this dramatic change in our populations. As we all know, we're all getting older, living longer, and thankfully very healthy for much of those long lives. And so we as individuals have to rethink these very long lives, but it also has implications for our families, communities, workplaces, governments. And we do research on that with colleagues around the world, and technology, of course, is one of the areas that is coming very much to the forefront of how do we address some of the issues of population aging. So when I began working in the field of population aging research, which is far too long ago, let's not bother about that, it was seen as a problem. You know, people were saying, oh my goodness, these increasing numbers of older people, they're going to bankrupt the pension systems, they're going to bring down the health and social care systems, what a terrible burden on the families, etc., etc., etc. Well, that's changed a little bit now. Just the sort of words we use in communicate how the moods are changing. So today it went from being a problem to being a challenge, and today it's seen very much as an opportunity that we need to grasp. Unfortunately, a lot of the infrastructures we have out there are not designed to serve an aging population. They're designed to serve young populations, which we don't have anymore. And you know, youth is disappearing rapidly as we speak, because we're the other side of population aging, of course, is that we've stopped having children, or at least we're certainly not having the number of children that our parents and grandparents had. All of these things are coming together, and we need to rethink this life course. But there is still, excuse me, there's still an issue around the provision of health and social care. Now, part of that is an increasing number of people getting old and at some point perhaps needing support in their homes, in their communities. The other part of it is that it's increasingly difficult to recruit human beings into the health and social care workforce. And that's where technologies are beginning to come in. And I couldn't help thinking as we were talking earlier about ways of finding something that we could wear and not worry about wearing, and it will monitor and it will send signals. Well, I think probably everyone sitting around this table is walking around with one of these devices all the time in their pocket, our mobile phones. And so there's a lot of advance there in mobile phone technology, which does register a lot of those things. Raises a lot of ethical issues, of course, because we are being monitored, and do we want to be monitored? And the chances of a signal being sent and the ambulance coming out or the fire brigade coming out and knocking your door down, and actually all you're doing is sitting having a cup of tea. You haven't fainted. The fact that you aren't moving around is because you're just sitting having a cup of tea. There are lots of issues around that. But we, in particular, at the Institute, we've been working very closely with a colleague of ours from Japan, Takanori Shibata, who has developed about 20 years ago now, almost one of the world's first what is called a therapeutic robot, which I have here.
So introduce us to your robot, George. So you can probably tell from the R's around the table that this robot doesn't look like perhaps people's stereotypical ideas of a robot. So describe the robot. Jean, what does this robot look like for people who can't see? It's lovely.
he's a real cuddly toy. Any child, anybody who's got part of their childhood retained in them, he's heavy on his head. Hey, all right, I'm not going to hurt you. He's heavier than he was last time, isn't he?
No, he's less. He's about the weight of a that size puppy.
He feels heavier to me. And that shows how I've aged in 2 years.
He's called Paro, and he's making some little noises there. Because you're stroking him right now, Jean. I think he's enjoying that. Stroking. So
he's wagging his tail. It almost feels as if it was a real baby. But no, I mean, you just want. That's enough.
So Paro is his factory name, if you like. But if you have a Paro and you decide to call him Fred, eventually Paro will realize, because he is state-of-the-art technology, both in terms of listening, reacting to both touch and sound, and he will realize, okay, I am not Paro anymore, I am Fred, and he will respond to Fred. And the idea behind Paro as a therapeutic robot is that he's exceptionally good at working with older people suffering from dementia, but also younger people suffering from autism, people for all sorts of reasons who probably have difficulty engaging with other people, making social relations, etc. And we see the reaction around the table here. You know, it immediately he becomes a source of conversation and a source of engagement. Initially on a one-to-one, as Jean began engaging with Paro, but then in a real life situation, for example, in a care home, the person maybe sitting opposite or next to whoever is engaging with Paro will also begin to engage with Paro, and eventually they begin to engage with one another, which would perhaps not happen. Also used to a great deal, particularly in Japan, in people's private homes, as a companion.
He's very cuddly, and he's a seal. So why why a seal? What's appealing about a seal to you, Jean or Sheila? What do you think?
I don't think it's because he's a seal. Mm. He's a lovely shape. Mm. He is the shape of a child, almost. Mm. It's the way, look at him, the way he moves his head. I know.
I think it's the way he responds to people. Yes. I mean, I can remember in the group, there was two young men there, and when they actually got hold of Paro, they became different people. They became really sort of affectionate and that, didn't they, Beth? It was amazing to see the change in them.
Mm. And I think it was like the smiles, the glow around the room. I know that some of the researchers at first were kind of backing away into the corners of the room thinking, what is this? Like, you know, this toy, like, is it infantilizing people? Like, what does it do? But actually, like, everyone else, like, we were sat there and we were absolutely, I mean, I'm glued now to Paro and watching everyone's interactions with it and seeing how it's lighting up the room just from its little...
And communication's what you need.
So Paro provides a way of helping people be in communication with each other, and he provides some communication.
I mean, your cuddly toys. I mean, I've got my cuddly toy right back. It's 84? It'll be 85 this Christmas. A teddy that my granny bought me my first Christmas.
The thing about Paro. So yes, you know, people will say, "Oh, but you can get toys that respond like this," which is absolutely true.
Oh, the babies and dolls that cry. It's not the same somehow.
But Paro does that, but lots more as well. I mean, there's a lot of research behind Paro.
Yes,
and he does. He is very good for
his eyes,
brain activity.
Yes,
he's very good for communication skills, and again, working with. People who do suffer from dementia, he has a really quite stunning calming effect. Mm. So you get a lot less wandering, you get a lot less agitation, and there are even trials with Paro which show that you can significantly reduce the medication that is needed to keep people calm, if you like, put it that way. And he does all of this.
That's right.
Yeah. So.
I wish he'd been there when my husband was, he was Parkinson's, a stroke.
Yeah, absolutely.
At the time he was calmest.
Yes.
It was when we were at my cousin's.
Exactly.
And the cat was on his lap. Mm.
Yeah, there is research around effects of sort of stroking pets, animals, cats and dogs, pet therapy. And so why would you go for something like Paro rather than a pet? That was my question when I first met Paro. I was like, why would you want a cuddly toy when you could have a real live cat? So why would you be superior?
Let me say again, he's not a toy. I keep saying that, but he's not a toy. Yeah. He's a very expensive toy if he is a toy. So why go for something like Paro? Well, I remember when I first met Takanori Shibata in Japan, and I asked him that question, why does this robot look like a seal? Mm-hmm. And I'll come back to the pet one. And he said, well, because we all know what a baby seal looks like. They look like this. This is very much like a baby seal. But we have no experience or expectation of a baby seal. So the first prototype was actually a cat, as you can imagine, in Japan. But of course, people have expectations of a cat, and no matter how good your robot at present, at least, is, it is not going to be a cat or a dog. Mm-hmm. And so this, if you like, was a sort of an impartial animal that people could relate to without having any expectation. Then in terms of pets, of course, not everyone is able to engage with a pet for all sorts of reasons. Maybe they don't like cats, they don't like dogs, or they're allergic, or maybe in the apartment block they live, they're not allowed to have pets, or in the home that they are living in, they're not allowed to have pets. So there are lots of barriers there. Think about Paro as well. He doesn't need to go for a walk. He doesn't poo or pee anywhere. Mm. And it's very, you know, he's a friendly.
You can switch him off.
And you can switch him off when you've had enough, Gina, as well.
And he's not unpredictable either. A cat or a real-life cat or dog could, if they're touched the wrong way, be a little bit unpredictable.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Having said that, Paro is, because of the technology that he has, he is able to sense, in a way, your mood. Mm. And his response to how you speak to him. It's funny that we're calling him a him, isn't it? Mm. The way we speak to him or the way we touch him will change. So if he senses you're angry, he will make different sounds, just as a dog would if you shout at a dog. They will not make happy sounds, and the way he responds. But otherwise, he won't run away and leave you. He's there with you for as long as you want him to be.
He's got the appealing eyes of a dog, hasn't he?
Yes.
As well.
Yeah.
So we have chosen to, maybe not explicitly, but we are referring to Paro as a he. We're certainly not calling him it. So we're giving him some personality, some identity, some character already, aren't we? And so he, one of the reasons he's so appealing is that he responds to you. So he is animate in some ways. So can you explain a little bit about what that means for a robot to be animate, George? What's going on there?
Oh gosh, what it means for the robot.
Well, it means for us to react to the robot. I mean, it's this isn't a toy that's going to sit there and be cuddled. It's not a dog that's going to run away or choose to turn around and bite you. Yeah. But he is an object that responds to.
Yeah, and he is specifically designed with a view to being able to respond to some very simple but fundamental and important human behaviours, if you like. And he's also able to stimulate behaviours which perhaps lie dormant or have been forgotten between people in groups. Mm. And it is stunning how successful Paro is in achieving that. You began, Gemma, by saying, you know, Paro is not what we expect of a robot, which is an interesting point to make, because I suppose what we expect of a robot, and a lot of the robots we see as prototypes, you know, in a way they're trying to mimic humans, as if we as humans feel more comfortable with a robot that actually looks like a human and has eyes and limbs. But increasingly, robots are not like that at all. Because, of course, that's not what they're going to be able to do. It's a bit like this is not a cat, because we know what a cat's going to do. Mm-hmm. And a robot that looks like a human. Now, having said that, humanoid robots are actually quite convincing, and they do look like humans. And
there's a big difference, though, between a robot that looks like a human and Paro. Paro looks cuddly. It wants you to cuddle it. A human robot hasn't got the same look about it.
No. The actual production of the robot in itself is interesting. So his fur is produced in a very traditional way that animal fur has been used in the past by Japanese, and also. Every Paro that leaves the production line, so to speak, a prayer is said, and he's given a soul. Mm-hmm. And if you then move this into mass production, the fear was, okay, that will disappear, and it won't be the Paro that they've designed and that they have wanted to give to the world, so to speak.
Are you like, do you wash it? Or?
No, this is getting very technical. There are special wipes antiseptic.
So you've got to have special wipes to do it.
Yeah, and of course that is because he is used in institutional settings. Well, he's used in institutional settings where you can have lots of different people handling him.
Yeah.
And in actual fact, so when we finished here today, and only Jean has touched him,
be careful.
He'll get a good wipe over when I get back to the institute. So you're supposed to be doing that for all sorts of reasons, infection, but also keeping the fur clean, of course, and making him still as cuddly as you think he is.
Mechanism inside of me. You can't really dunk it, can you?
Well, you could not with the electronics that are inside. It wouldn't be useful putting it in.
And I guess it is I was quite sceptical and a bit sort of wary of Paro, the idea of Paro, before I met him. And I think one of the things that made me wary is that he seems so simple and innocent with his big eyes and his lovely soft fur, but actually he contains this amazing technology that I don't really understand. And I find that a bit unnerving. So you said earlier, George, that he learns your responses. So he might, for example, learn a new name. How can a robot learn?
Well, gosh, if I were able to do that, I'd be producing my. I tell you that I'd be able to produce my own robots. But he's programmed. So for example, someone orders a Paro, and he's going off. Where shall we? He's going off to Mexico, and so he's programmed in Mexican Spanish, so to speak, and he can understand. It's up to, I think, 30 or 40 words. But you're not told which words you can understand. But obviously they are relevant to the situations that he's going into.
So is that what gives the element of slight unpredictability that we need for him to appear animate? The fact that we don't know which words will make him respond? Is that the...
Yeah, I think so. And I think also the fact that... It's not just the noises he makes that is a response. It's also, as Jean pointed out, the movement he makes. So that if you are doing something to him or saying something to him that makes him feel happy, goodness me, we're talking about a robot here, that makes him feel happy, then with one person he'll wag his tail, with another person he'll look into your eyes and bat his eyelids, and that produces another response in us. In a way, it's a self-strengthening sort of relationship that you build up. So it's state-of-the-art technology in terms of both understanding and responding and hearing and feeling. But it is, having said that, it's relatively simple. You know, he can't make a cup of coffee any more than a humanoid could make a cup. We think making a cup of coffee is very simple, but getting a robot to do that is, you know, and having made the coffee, getting that coffee into a cup, I mean, listen, you know, it's easier to get someone to the moon, almost.
What worries me slightly, because I appreciate that he is an incredible feat of engineering, and he obviously has a lot of therapeutic benefits and stuff, and there is this debate, or was this debate, in some parts of academia where there was a worry that warm care would be replaced by cold technology. Obviously, Paro is not a cold piece of technology because he's very warm and cuddly. We've said that he won't replace care, but I do kind of wonder about how far, if we kind of stick mom or dad in a care home or whatever, and then say, okay, I've given them a Paro, what then does it allow me to not do?
Yeah.
You know, it's not a replacement. It's just, it's kind of that pressure is alleviated, which is a great thing, but also could...
I completely understand. And that's why I say that the technologies need to be people-driven.
Exactly,
and people's needs driven. Yeah. So as far as Paro is concerned, he doesn't actually enable professional care staff not do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because
it helps the person that's having the care.
Yeah.
Relax.
Yes, and you need
and
a professional
be,
to
be able to accept the care.
Yeah, you need a professional to instigate the. If nothing else, you need the professional to bring Paro to the table, switch him on, and monitor what's going on. But I agree entirely. There are, you know, there is a danger, and these technologies are being developed.
Mm-hmm.
There is a danger that those technologies will be totally devoid of the need for any human being to be anywhere.
Mm.
Now, we might be able, as individuals, to say, well, there are actually certain tasks in caring for very frail, dependent, not just older people, but younger people, which actually I might like a robot to do rather than me having to do it. Let's not go into detail, but we can imagine what they might be. And that would be a good thing. And maybe it would be a really good thing if it freed up from some time for the professional, as Jean said, to actually sit and talk to me and have a cup of coffee with me rather than running about and doing all of this.
Well, that makes you feel so much better.
Yeah.
I mean, I am terrified of having to go into a home.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrified. I'd rather have a cancer back, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Because the thought of spending my days, last days, in a home. I mean, I've seen so many people anyway, friends of mine who've had to go, not able to look after themselves, or told they can't look after themselves anymore. So and then all of a sudden you're under their crutches and that's it.
So if there was technology that enabled you to live at home, you would welcome it?
I want to stay at home, yeah.
Paro's joining in. For the benefit of the podcast, Paro is doing a circle at the moment.
We look slightly more reticent on this side of the table.
But it's coming back to what you were saying, Jim, about accepting Paro. One of the first times I saw reactions to Paro was a conference in Copenhagen in Denmark, which I was organising, a big international conference, and Takanori came over with his team and some Paros. And of course, Denmark is a truly professionalised welfare state. And the reaction from the professional groups was very, very dismissive. We almost had a diplomatic incident, of course.
Really?
And today, Denmark, relatively speaking, per capita, has more paros than any other country in the world. But they, you know, their professional workforce hasn't been reduced.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you to George, to Jean, to Sheila, Caitlin, Beth and Josie. We've had a really interesting discussion about a really fascinating piece of technology, if I can refer to Paro in that way. And we've touched on some really fundamental questions about how best to age, where to age, what the ethics of using new technologies and robots might be. So thank you very much for joining me in conversation this afternoon. If you haven't already done so, you can hear more about the Messy Realities Project in earlier episodes of this podcast. So thank you very much, everybody.